for question and answer and discussion at the end. And then we'll have some tea and refreshments informally in the kitchen afterwards.
Yeah.
Good evening. It's nice to be here. And first of all, I just want to say how happy I am being here. I love this lineage, and I love what Kate and Michael and many of you are trying to do here in this space, in this neighborhood, in this era where our culture is designed to kill poetry and meditative practice. So, can you hear me? Is that a little bit better? Okay. If my voice starts to fade away, just wave.
And I think we will turn off the fan if people are prepared to practice with being hot Buddhas.
And I guess I also just want to say that it's bittersweet being here too, because I ran a center much like this in Toronto for more than 10 years, and I announced 2 years ago that I was going to be leaving, and I spent 2 years managing people's emotions around that, and I feel like coming here tonight, it was the first time where I suddenly felt a kind of longing for what I left, and also how much I miss urban communities, and so I just want to acknowledge that also. So I'd like to begin tonight with a metaphor from a wonderful book that I just finished called The Argonauts by a poet from California named Maggie Nelson. I don't know how many of you have picked it up yet, but please do. And the title of the book is named after many things, one of which is a Greek myth of the Argo, which is a ship that took a very difficult journey and had to be repaired and renewed many times through the journey, so that by the time it ended up at its final destination, it was not the same ship that started the destination. And in Maggie Nelson's book, which is named after this story, she writes a lot about Roland Barthes' interpretation of this, which is that every time we say, I love you, we have to renew it. So in the same way that the ship was constantly renewed, every time we say, I love you, or we make room for love, we have to take this vow of renewal. And so in my relationship with my partner, Karina, we've been playing with this all week. So every time I say I love you to her, and then she just sometimes unconsciously says, oh, I love you. I said, do you renew it? Did you renew it? And then sometimes she'll say, I love you, and I'll say, okay, good night, I love you. And she said, did you renew it? And I'll say, you know, 5%. So this is what I want to talk about tonight. I want to unpack this metaphor through the lens of this practice that we're all doing, which one could say is this practice of every moment renewing our love for our lives, our love for one another, our love for this planet that's really in need of our care, and also our love for moods and mental states that are not the mental states that we love. So hopefully I'll speak for less than 40 minutes, then we'll have some time to stretch our legs, and then we can have a discussion or a debate or whatever happens. Does this sound reasonable? Yeah. So, one of the most well-known terms, obviously, in the Buddha's teaching is the term nirvana in Sanskrit, or nibbana in Pali. And one of the cool things that you can do nowadays, because all of these texts are online, is you can go to the online Pali website, of which there are three, The best one is hosted by the University of Cologne in Germany. And you can type in any word, and then it'll show you within the 8,000 pages of the canon everywhere it's shown up. And so you can go on, unfortunately it's not in English, it's actually in Pali, but still, if you go and you type in the word Nibbana, which is the Pali version of Nirvana, which is what everyone translates as enlightenment, it's very interesting what comes up, which is how the Buddha defined Nirvana. And I thought that we could spend some time on this tonight because it's one of the most kind of misunderstood terms. And I think it is very much an idea and a practice that brings together many of the different Buddhist traditions. So if you type in Nibbana, one of the first references you get is the Buddha describing how Nirvana is immediate. And not only is it immediate, he also calls it the unconditioned. And unfortunately, translators who have translated this term, the unconditioned, or sometimes he calls it the deathless, have translated it with this prefix the, which you can't do in Pali or Sanskrit, and also with capital letters. Have you seen this? You know, the unconditioned, or the deathless, or enlightenment with a capital E. But there actually are no Pali letters, capital letters in Pali or Sanskrit. I don't know about Japanese, but...
No, there aren't.
There aren't, yeah. So this is very interesting. So this is a warning for all of you, you know, nerds out there, is whenever you're reading original source material, and you see a capital letter, all the flags should go up. Original mind, Buddha nature, enlightenment. So the Buddha says Nirvana, that's not capitalized. The Buddha says Nirvana is immediate, and it's unconditioned and deathless. So what does this mean? It's unconditioned. Well, if you poke a little further, he then says Nirvana is unconditioned by greed, anger, and delusion. This is his definition of Nirvana. But if you take that definition of Nirvana and you capitalize it, it sounds like every other religion, which is that if you're not greedy, if you're not angry, and if you're not deluded, then you will get into some eternal state that is Nirvana. But I think what the Buddha is doing here is he's suggesting that if Nirvana or awakening is immediate, then it's right now. So any moment in time that is unconditioned by greed, which is raga, unconditioned by aversion, dvesha, and unconditioned by confusion, moha, which nowadays I translate as boredom. Greed, anger, and boredom. So any moment in time that's unconditioned by greed. Now it's interesting that before the Buddha, the word for greed, raga, meant craving for pleasurable experience. Does everybody know that? So it's like not as far on the spectrum that, you know, we call greed, but we can notice in our meditative practice that almost every second you're looking for pleasure. Does anybody notice this? And I always joke that the hardest people to meditate are yogis and dancers. Because when you've spent a lot of time doing body work, although you're very embodied, you're also quite addicted to sensations. So when sensations arise, it feels like you've got to do something about them right away. And I thought it would be a good art project sometimes to do like to film yogis sitting in a room and then turn the speed up. So it would be, you know, like... it's like post-modern dancing, you know. Neo-modern dance. So we can notice that biologically, any moment that arises that has displeasure in it tends to be a moment where we're looking for pleasure. Even craving peace is a way of trying to have a different mind moment than the moment we're having right now. So this is the first thing. So nirvana is a moment unconditioned by attachment. Can everybody relate to that? The second one, dvesha, the Buddha uses that term to talk about anger, but actually the word dvesha before the Buddha meant aversion, any kind of aversion, which is leaning away from something that we're experiencing. And everybody has a spectrum of what they can allow into their experience and what they relegate outside of their experience. So you can notice that every moment you're toggling back and forth between wanting pleasure and wanting to get away from what's not pleasurable. And you could argue that maybe that's actually the same thing. Because wanting pleasure is aversion to what's not pleasurable. And aversion to what's not pleasurable is actually an addiction to pleasure, you see. Did that make sense at all? Okay. And the third piece, moha, which usually gets translated as ignorance, delusion, or confusion, there's one scholar named Richard Gombrich who translates it as aridity, which is the opposite of fertility or the opposite of creativity. And so I take it a little bit of a step further and translate it as boredom, which probably a scholar wouldn't like very much. But I think it actually captures the experience of going around in circles that we call confusion. So the Buddha is saying that any moment in time when you can come back to embodied breathing and come back to the present moment, that's a moment of nirvana. And the Buddha did not invent the term nirvana. It actually comes from gastrology and was a term used by cooks to talk about taking a pot off of a flame. So nirvana is this process of taking the personality off the flame of greed, off the flame of anger, and off of the flame of boredom, which burns us. Burns us. Cooling things down. This is our practice. Cooling things down. So, when you're sitting, you'll notice that there's a very strong tendency to daydream. And then you notice the daydreaming and you wake up. You come back to your breath. And what if we imagine that this is nirvana? Which I would say is totally in line with what Dogen is saying. Which is that nirvana is right here. Awakening is right here. The fruition of our entire practice can only be experienced in this moment. And yet, when we sit, how often are we trying to get somewhere? Or maybe we experience pain that we can't bear. So what do you do with pain during the day when you can't take care of your pain? You project it onto other people. Or you turn it against yourself. This is how we start wars, even with ourselves. So the heart of this practice is learning how to be intimate with what's actually happening in our moment-to-moment experience. This is the beginning of personal healing, and this is the beginning also of social healing. Because we notice that all the time, when we're motivated by greed, we can't see outside of our experience. When we're motivated by anger, we're always right. And they're always wrong. And the great thing about anger is that it's mobilizing, it's energizing, But when you're angry, you can't get much good done. But you can sure gather a lot of people. But collaboration's impossible. So, before the Buddha's time in ancient India, every family had in their household three fires going. This was a traditional practice that would happen in all kinds of households, but was formalized in Brahmin households. And if you go to a Hindu temple here in Vancouver, you'll notice they have either symbolically one fire, or they'll have three fires going. And it's said that when someone moved out of the house, they would actually take the family fire. And I don't know if nowadays they take it on airplanes or whatever they do. But I think this is a beautiful practice of keeping the family lineage going, keeping relationship with ancestors going by keeping a fire in one's home. So the Buddha, he had an interesting take on these fires, where he said, we actually all have three fires, but they're actually burning in our own hearts. So he internalized this idea of the three fires. And that the three fires are attachment, we really want pleasurable experience to continue. Aversion, there are certain feelings and moods we just can't tolerate. And the fire of boredom, which you might not think of a fire, but it really burns us. And the reason why I'm focusing so much on boredom is because I feel like that's the energy that most of us can't tolerate nowadays. And we see it in young people, you know. Young people these days have a very hard time being bored. Why? Because they see adults around them unable to be bored. Every time you're bored as an adult, you pick up your phone. Pat O'Hara, a Zen teacher in New York, she always says, modern people are rectangle people. She lives in New York City, where you walk around and everyone has a rectangle in front of their head. So she just calls them rectangle people, which I like very much. It's like the new smoking, you know. Yeah. What happens when you don't pick it up? You see? Yeah. My partner, she just got rid of her iPhone and got one of those just like old school phones that you open up. And she said, I just don't feel important anymore. So, if we have this image of nirvana as this experience that we've all had, of being able to relate to what's happening in the present moment, unconditioned by greed. You see what the Buddha is doing here? He's taking what's often considered a noun, right? Like the unconditioned is basically God. And he's turning it into a verb. To be unconditioned by greed, unconditioned by anger, and a moment of that's unconditioned by boredom is a moment of creativity. A moment unconditioned by anger is a moment of creativity, right? Because we have space to respond to what's happening. A monk once asked Yunmen, what's your practice? And he responded, an appropriate response. So how can we respond appropriately or respond creatively to what's happening inside us and around us if we're conditioned in that moment by greed, anger, or confusion, or boredom? The other word that's used to describe nirvana, so one of them is the unconditioned, which hopefully we've unpacked a little bit. The other is often translated as the deathless. Have any of you heard of this before? The deathless. The word in Sanskrit is amrit. Which interestingly, in front of a word, the A, turns the word into its opposite. So mrt is where you get the word mortal. It's also where you get the English word meal. So it means, you know, not mortal, which usually gets translated as immortality or the deathless. It's interestingly, through Greek, it's where you get the word ambrosia, right? Like the nectar of immortality. But if we unpack this a little bit, let's think about this. What does it mean to be deathless, i.e., not dead? When you're sitting in meditative practice and you see how your attention sticks to certain ideas or images or memories and then starts making loops out of them, do you know what I'm talking about? No? Do you not have this on the east side? Yeah, it's called ruminating. And I think it's actually one of the most painful parts of the beginning phase of meditation is to sit on retreat and realize you're crazy. You're crazy. And not only are you insane, but there are so many old memories that you just can't let go of. It's like there's this groove in the mind that just goes over and over and over, unable to forgive, unable to let go. That experience is an experience of being dead. It's an experience of being unable to respond to what's actually happening in this moment. So when we say the deathless, rather than thinking of it, what do you think of when you think of the deathless? It's like, whoa, being lit up like on acid or something, you know. The deathless is a moment in time where you're not dead. And I think any of us can be idealistic and say, okay, well then the goal of practice is no greed, no anger, no boredom. But I think we also know that human beings deep down are not greedy and not bored and not angry. We also know that we have the experience all the time of having relationships with what's arising that's free of the habits of our conditioning. And we also know when we're caught in cycles of rumination about the past or planning the future, where we're dead. We all have this, I think, right? We all just really want to be comfortable. We want to meet somebody. I hope David Loy talked about romantic love a little bit when he was here last week. Did he? I don't know. This is a good topic that he gets into. A little bit. We want to meet somebody. We fall in love. We want an apartment, condo. Is that what you do here? Get condos? Nice couch. And then we get comfortable, and in us, we die a little bit also. Sometimes we're a little too comfortable, and we're not awake. And I don't mean this literally. I mean this experience we have in our job, in our creative habits, in our relationships, where we're so comfortable that we don't have beginner's mind anymore. We're experts. So comfortable that we're actually dead. So nirvana is the space that opens up when we have the ability to let go of greed, recognize it, to let go of anger, to really recognize it. And when you recognize something, it really loses its power, doesn't it? You watch a story that's repeating and repeating, and the more closely you watch it with non-reactive awareness, the less power it has. And this is what we do in our practice, is we're trying to get just enough distance from the content of what's arising that we're not compulsive. So nirvana is the end of compulsion. Nirvana is the absence of a moment inflected by greed, anger, or the fire of boredom. Does this make sense a little bit? In other words, nirvana is the opposite of being dead. It's the opposite of being dead. And in that space, we become much more like water. Or much more like the Argo. And this is the space of love, which is identical to the space of creativity, which is the process of seeing your life as an art project, seeing your life as elastic, as something that's constantly in motion, because the opposite is death, death and life. And I'm sure all of us have had the experience of waking up and realizing a big part of me is dead. So in this paradigm, our Buddha nature is our capacity for imagination. Our Buddha nature is the ability to re-see our experience in a new way. We can call it insight, we can call it original mind, we can call it deathless, we can call it nirvana, but it's a moment where we're not compulsively acting out a rehearsed response to what's arising. And some students really need to learn how to do this so that they can become one with whatever they're feeling, whatever they're experiencing, or whoever they're relating to. And some students get that really easy, and their work is actually to become one with being two. And if you look at the koans, half the koans are about oneness, and half the koans are about just wash your bowls. My reading of Zen is it doesn't have anything to do with one or two. Duality and non-duality. It has to do with being intimate with what's going on. And there are some mental states that you can't get any distance from. Sometimes the pain is so big that you can't get any distance from it. And then you need community to help you. Because maybe Zazen is not going to do it. You need other people. You say, I can't sit with it. There's no way I can sit with this. It's too painful. I'm a big fan of medication. Sometimes you have a mind that encounters certain states. You can't work with them. So sometimes you need some pharmaceutical help. Or sometimes you need a really good friendship. We need to be awake, but we need help being awake. We can't do it all by ourselves. That's why a space like this is so beautiful. You can come to this space pretty broken, I think. And then maybe when you have some healing from your brokenness, you keep coming to this space. And then you recognize the brokenness in other people. And you can be a Buddha for them. Why? Because nobody gets enlightened. Sorry. But all of us know what it's like to be in delusion and to be dead. Dogen says, awakening is to be awake in delusion. Not from delusion, but right in delusion, to see that. It's so hard to do. It's so hard to change your mind, isn't it? So, let's back up a little bit. We have these three fires. Do you remember what they are? What's the first one?
Greed.
Yeah, attachment. Attachment. What's the second one?
Aversion.
Yeah, aversion or anger. And the third one?
Boredom.
Yeah, boredom. Don't tell anybody that I said boredom, because it's going to come back to haunt me, but I think it's a good one. When we're caught in those states, it's very, very hard to be responsive. Mm-hmm. And those states are inside us, but they're also around us too. It's not like greed is just in your own heart. Greed is also institutional. It's not like anger is just in you. Anger is also institutional. It's structural. And it's not just like you get bored. Boredom is also built into our architecture. It's built into our education system. So then we have to make the link between recognizing that when you work on your own greed, you're doing social action. When you work on your own capacity for killing, I love it. That's a practice of social action. Because when you recognize this capacity in yourself, then you don't act it out in your family. You don't act it out in your relationships. You don't act it out in the Sangha. So when you sit still on your cushion, you're doing a profound form of political action. Mindfulness is a political practice. Because if you can look after your greed, you're not going to buy useless stuff. And that's why Zen is going to be illegal. Because it's going to kill the gross national product. So enjoy this place while we can still do this.
Where they audit us into tax exempt status.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, sorry, we're not going to record tonight. Yeah. So, what I'm hoping is coming across tonight is that this whole notion of nirvana has been co-opted by religion and ratcheted up as a state that men can achieve, separated from the domestic, separated from the everyday messy lives that we're all in. And rather to see nirvana as temporal, to see nirvana as a moment of time when we're not dead, a moment of time that's unconditioned by the three fires. And that, you have a moment of peace, you really know it, which is the third noble truth, you know it, and then you let go of it. Because the next moment could be a moment of greed. You see. So how do you do this? Two stages. The first one is really having the courage to be able to sit with whatever's coming up. And I think, because I'm a meditation cheerleader, that you have to have a daily practice to do this. that every day you roll out of bed and you get on your Zafu and you sit there. And you follow your breathing and you allow the winds, the weather patterns, whatever's showing up for you to move through awareness. So that during the day, when someone says something to you that irritates you, when a colleague at work takes a position you completely disagree with, the practice is right there, right there. If you just have the attitude, oh, everything's practice, everything's Zen, good luck. Great attitude, but the resource isn't there. It's not right there, you see. So this is a practice. Really important. So that's the first piece. And I call that piece the courage to be intimate. The courage to be so close to what's happening. And that's not just inside you. And then the second phase is not to hold on to it. So we're so close to what's actually right in front of us, and we're not holding on to it either. So there's your koan. How do you love something with your whole heart and not hold on to it? Some of us were just working on the first phase, which is turning towards something, turning towards somebody, walking beside somebody. And some of us were really working on the second phase. It's okay, I can turn towards this, but now I'm really holding on to it. So also, how do I not hold on to it? And that's what we're doing in practice. Letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go. Making space for love to emerge. And then you renew the love. Every time you breathe, you renew this moment every time you blink your eyes. The first meditation instruction I ever got was from a Tibetan Buddhist teacher. And he grew up in charnel grounds. He lived in charnel grounds for 9 years. Do you know what a charnel ground is? We don't have them around here, but it's where dead bodies are put. Sometimes just to decay completely, sometimes before they're cremated. And so anyways, I had a meeting with this teacher. He was in his 80s. And I said, I was novice, you know, so I asked the question that every novice meditator says is, how long should I meditate for? He could see me coming from a mile away. And he said, just blink your eyes. So I had no idea what he meant. So I asked the translator, what's he saying? And the translator said, you heard him. Just blink your eyes. And that was the practice. So you should try this sometime. Every time you remember, you just blink your eyes, and that moment is gone. That's how you work with the letting go part. Every time you blink your eyes, every time you exhale, it's over. Maybe tonight you had a nice night here. You blink your eyes. That's it. That's it. And what's left when you can let go? Your imagination. Creativity. The ability to have an unrehearsed relationship with your life. Do you understand what I mean by that? Not conditioned. And this is deathless. Timeless. So this is our practice. And the last thing I'll say is that it only works in the context of having a daily practice. Because you don't know how you're going to need to serve. Next week, next month, 2 years. My generation is the generation where our parents are losing our minds. How are you going to be with that? So we train every day, not just for us, but so that we can really and truly serve others. But if you're still working out patterns of greed that just own you, patterns of anger in relationships that still have such a strong grip, it's going to be very hard to serve, because you'll be such a narrow version of yourself. So that's why I like Roland Barthes' commentary on the Argo, saying that every time you say, "I love you," every time you blink, every time you breathe, you renew the whole thing, all your vows, right there. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think it would be nice if we had a couple minutes just to stretch our legs, and then we can have some discussion.
Feel free to stand up. Not room to...